Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson, sitting in with John Gee and Kevin Christensen. Good evening, John. Good evening, Kevin.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome back to the Interpreter Foundation radio program this evening. Now, as we often do, our second hour this evening is going to be a segment on the Come Follow Me, and we're a few weeks out, so tonight's Come Follow Me section is going to cover Deuteronomy. Kevin, tell us a little bit about this one.
Okay. Well, the lesson is going to emphasize about covenants, and that the covenants we make keep, you know, one of the references is, keep therefore the words of the covenant and do them that ye may prosper in all you do. And this is like a Book of Mormon theme, keep the commandments and ye shall prosper in the land. Okay, so what Deuteronomy is, according to the Bible dictionary, words means repetition of the law, or I've heard second law. The book contains the three last discourses of Moses delivered in the plains of Moab just before his death. There's the discourse in 1 through 4, an introduction, second discourse 5 to 26, with the Ten Commandments and an exposition of them, and then a code of laws that's the core of the whole book. And there's laws about the ritual, laws against idolatrous objects and worship instances, false worship, various commandments and things, regulating private and social rights. Then there's the covenant renewal, announcement of blessings, and the curses for disobedience. And Hugh Nibley gave wrote a really interesting talk on this that's in his What is Zion, a Distant View, called How to Get Rich. And he points out that everything in Deuteronomy is strictly here and now. There's nothing about the afterlife. And he goes through the covenants that people are expected to keep, you know, one of them, like, remember the stranger, you know, because you were a stranger in Egypt, and remember the orphans and the widows, and things that we're not really living up to. Then he, at the end of the chapter, he goes through the covenant curses, or the covenant curse is the reversal of the blessing, because you don't keep the commandment, you get the opposite. And one of the things that he mentions that you get is that you'll have pandemics. So it's very timely and apt and interesting. So that goes beyond what's in the lesson, but there's a lot to think about with Deuteronomy.
You know, Kevin, I'm really sorry that you went beyond what was in the lesson.
I actually was going to bring up the blessings and cursings myself. And a lot of those times we tend to emphasize in the modern world that we want to talk about the blessings, we want to talk about the positive things, and yet the curses are there as well, and they're the flip side of the same coin. And my favorite example of this is in Alma, I think it's 45, where Alma says, and he blessed the land, saying, cursed be the land to all who, and that's part of the, if you bless it for one thing, you're also cursing it for the flip side of that. We may be seeing, as you pointed out, some of these curses that we're facing today for some of the same problems.
Well, you know, that's part of the ancient covenant pattern, if I remember correctly, is that in the Old Testament, when, you know, and there's different levels of those, the covenant treaty pattern, whatever it is, you have a pledge and you have a blessing, but you also state what the curse was, what the curse is going to be. And while it's not emphasized the way it used to be, it's even part of the modern temple endowment, where you talk about the blessings and you talk about the cursings. And yet our culture doesn't want to hear about cursings. It's like we're plugging our ears and going, la, 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 you know, if I can't hear about it, I'm not going to do it. Or if you're going to talk about a cursing, which I think you could say a parallel word would be consequence. There are going to be a consequence.
Well, no, the consequences, say the generic, the neutral term for both blessing and curses.
Well, that's true. That's true. But, you know, when you're doing something against the covenant, if you will, or against the commandment, then you know that consequence is going to be negative. But people, in our culture say, oh, you're criticizing me personally. You're not saying this. I mean, my wife and I were reading the Bruce McConkie's Millennial Messiah recently, and it's been a long time since one of the brethren really laid it out quite in that way, although I think Elder Kieran came close in his latest conference talk.
Yeah, there's a lot of those curses, but interestingly is these blessings and cursings are read on Mount Ebal, and that's been in the news this last month, of where they've discovered, we'll have to wait till the final report comes out, but apparently from 13th century, there is a curse tablet from Mount Ebal, which is the earliest record we have of the Lord and worship of the Lord in the land of Israel. And the second earliest mention of the Lord that I know of, and it's on a full pledge curse.
Mm-hmm.
But Ebal is where they had the blessings and cursings, and half side chants out the blessing, the other half chants out the cursings. And they are two sides of the same coin. You can look at the curse as withholding from you the blessing, but also the curse is a reminder of the consequences of not keeping the covenants. And we aren't a society that honors covenants very much, or that really wants other people to honor their covenants. We have lots of disincentives, at least socially, against honoring your covenants. And we could pick all kinds of indicators of this, but
yeah, you could watch the Academy Awards just this last week and see a lot of that.
Yeah, and we see all kinds of ramifications of the curses that attach you. You can look at recent events and say, yeah, this does line up with curses. And what we don't do as a society is say, and therefore, we probably need to make some changes so that we can come out from under the curse. We want the blessings on our terms, not God's. And we don't want to talk about cursings. We don't want to talk about judgment. We want to say, well, don't judge me, even though Jesus gave us very specific cases where we're required to.
You know, Kevin, Deuteronomy has always fascinated me for a couple of reasons. And one of them happens to be the emphasis and the almost the change. Partly there's some different emphases in the laws, the legal code, I should say, that's given in Deuteronomy versus the one in Exodus. And I did a paper on that in law school, and that's the one I've talked about from Professor Welch, where my grade was fairly modest. In fact, modest would be generous. But he said, this could be publishable if you spend 10 years and learn some languages. But the thing that strikes me about it is the change in the nature of the way they describe God. And in the change in the nature of where they worship and kind of how they worship. And I know Margaret talks about the Deuteronomists and those who change that in great detail. But, you know, as I read the Book of Mormon when I wrote my paper, it followed those changes from Deuteronomy. So if it's in the Book of Mormon and they were doing that, to me, there's certain elements of it that Neil Rapley describes in his in an interpreter article he did about a year or so ago about the family dynamics in Lehi's family and some of the Deuteronomistic reforms. But I just keep seeing that, and it's like I was talking to David Seeley, and he said, well, you know, there's a lot of things to be said about the way that the Deuteronomists are portrayed, even in Margaret's, although she's probably out there a little farther than he would agree with. But he said, Jesus loved Deuteronomy. He quotes it in the Gospels all the time. So where do we come in as Latter-day Saints with this? I know the lesson emphasizes some very important things that we'll get to. But this is something that anybody who's read or studied a lot about the Old Testament and some of the breakdown about how it was compiled or what some of these theories are is going to run across this as being a little bit of a different thing.
Well,
somewhere in there, there was a question as I was rambling on.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have a story in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles about the discovery of the Book of the Law during the reign of King Josiah. And the stories are a little bit different. And one of the stories, it's the discovery of a book by the high priest. They bring it to Josiah. And that's in the King's account, it's the discovery of this Book of the Law starts the reform, because he reads and they realize we haven't been keeping the covenant. So King Josiah, repents in sackcloth and ashes, and he starts this whole thing. Whereas in Chronicles, they find the book during the reform, during the renovation of the temple as part of the reform. So we've got these two slightly different accounts. But the idea is this, that the book that is found is basically, they recognize that that's at least a version of Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy then becomes associated with this, and this re-emphasis on Moses and the Passover. That happens with King Josiah. And it's kind of an echo of an earlier one that was done in the time of Hezekiah. And then this happens during Lehi's lifetime. And then King Josiah is killed by the Egyptians and Jehoiakim is installed. And then you've got about an 11-year period where the Egyptians are in charge. And that's when Nephi's boys grow up. They grew up under this. And then Jehoiakim is deposed by the Babylonians. And then they put in Zedekiah. And that's where the Book of Mormon starts. So the Book of Mormon is right in the middle of all of this. And so you do get, I think Noel Reynolds some years ago did an essay for the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, emphasizing how Deuteronomy is used in the Book of Mormon. And so there's, especially the real conspicuous emphasis on, if you obey my commandments, you will prosper in the land, which is, that's, you keep the covenant and you will be blessed. And that, that's something that the Book of Mormon just harps on over and over and over. Then on the other hand, this is where Margaret comes in, and she points out that there are a couple of things that aren't quite, square with what we might expect if you look closer. And then she calls this is from the Great Angel. And this is her book that really a lot of Mormon scholars started to go on. And it's this passage right here that got me. First, they were to have the law instead of wisdom. That's Deuteronomy 4:6. What was the wisdom which the law replaced? Second, they were to think of only of the formless voice of God sounding from the fire and giving the law. That's Deuteronomy 19:12. Israel had long had a belief in the vision of God when the glory had been visible on the throne in human form, surrounded by the heavenly hosts. What happened to the visions of God? And third, they were to leave the veneration of the hosts of heaven to peoples not chosen by Yahweh. Deuteronomy 4:19-20. Israel had long regarded Yahweh as the Lord of the hosts of heaven, but the title Yahweh of hosts was not used by the Deuteronomists. And this is this, a school of people who edited records in the Kara. They didn't necessarily compose them, but they imposed their view on their key issues on these things. And she says, what happened to the hosts and the angels? And then later in her book on the revelation of Jesus Christ, she added references to two more prescriptions. The Jews were not to inquire after secret things which belonged only to the Lord, Deuteronomy 29:29. Their duty was to obey the commandments brought down from Sinai and not seek anyone who would ascend to heaven for them to discover remote and hidden things, Deuteronomy 30:11. So you've got my background for reading that is I'd read Friedman's Who Wrote the Bible, and he claimed that Jeremiah agreed with the Deuteronomic history on practically every important point and agreed with Deuteronomy on virtually every major point. And I realized after reading these passages, well, Deuteronomy also disagrees on these passages. So if he agrees so much on these particular points, they must be important. Because if you know Deuteronomy well enough to quote it lots and lots of times and use similar language, then you know what it says. But on these points, there's disagreement. And that's, what Margaret says, this is the agenda of the Deuteronomists. And this is where they differ from Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Lehi and Nephi and Jacob. So there's something going on there, and this is in Lehi's lifetime, and so this is the key tensions, and they all actually have to do with the temple. What goes on in the temple? Do you have just a law book in the temple, or do you have Revelation?
Well, there's also the factor from the loss of the first temple. So you have the ark that's there, and then when they rebuild it, it's not there anymore. They have the foundation stone.
And so you
have the place where the ark is the place where it's the place of Revelation, where you go to the temple to see the face of the Lord, and I guess before this text that John was talking about, this little 13th century little fragment that they got. One of the oldest ones before that was this middle scroll from Jerusalem, 600 BC, which quotes the priestly blessing from Numbers. You know, this is another book of Moses, but it's written on metal. And it quotes the priestly blessing about coming up to see the face of the Lord.
And it's actually interesting that
May the Lord's face shine upon you, which is what happens in 3 Nephi. So the oldest biblical text has to do with, you know, zeros right, at least before this other one. Well, that's not a biblical text. So the oldest biblical text is this quotation from the priestly blessing from Numbers about going to the temple and having the Lord's face shine upon you, which happens in 3 Nephi with the Lord. And it's reflects this tension that goes on, you know, and do you just have a law book? Do you just have a set of rules, or do you have ongoing revelation? And that's really central to what's going on here. Somebody's going to keep the book and says, all we need is the book. And once we've got the book and the lawyers, then we can control what it says. And that's all we need. Because if you've got a prophet, you don't know what he's going to do next.
Yeah. That's one of the differences between, say, a prophet and a theologian or a philosopher, is you can predict what the latter is going to tell you, and they may not be what the Lord, anything have to do with what the Lord has said. I wanted to look at pose a little different way of looking at this discovery of the book of the law of the Lord under Josiah. Margaret Barker follows a lot of biblical scholars in connecting this with Deuteronomy. But the fact is, we don't know that it's Deuteronomy. We do know that they're not doing hardly anything of the law of Moses before the time of Josiah. So when it says it found the scroll of the law of the Lord, how do we know that this is in Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, as well as Deuteronomy, because they're not following the Passover. In fact, they've got a lot of institutions in Israel that count against the Passover. You have this whole system of corvée labor where you're required as an Israelite to go spend 1 month out of three or four, out of every three or four, working on whatever projects the king wants you to do. And this is well established in Solomon's time. It's actually the overseer of the corvée is actually the one that they're stoned to death when Rehoboam sends him up to execute, have them do this with Israel right after Solomon's death. But we have seals from that official, so we know they're doing it later. And yet it runs counter to everything in the whole Exodus and Passover narrative. If you're worshiping, if you're doing Passover every year, you have, and you've got this corvée labor, you'd have to have Israelites saying, now how are we better off than we were in Egypt? So there are a number of facets about that don't quite square with the evidence we have. It's a very popular idea that they discovered Deuteronomy and they talk about Deuteronomy.
I mean, it goes back to the 1800s.
Right. It's very standard in biblical scholarship, but there's not a lot of basis for that. And so there are other ways of reading this narrative. And so, for Latter-day Saints who think that this narrative sounds a little strange, well, it's not necessarily the narrative that actually shows up in the Bible. It's one way to read it, but it's not the only way to read it, and there's other evidence that doesn't support it. So in this case, it's probably better to keep a more open mind on that issue. It's what sort of evidence do you actually have to justify one reading over another?
Well, and it's like I pointed out earlier, I think there's evidence that Deuteronomy in particular was on the brass plates, because many of the legal things that we see in the Book of Mormon and some of the ways they set up their cities and other things fall in line with the Deuteronomic version of those laws as opposed to the one from Exodus.
And while we're on that topic, why don't we just dive into the text itself, and probably the best place is Deuteronomy 6, because this is a passage that's well familiar. So there, in verse 3 of chapter 6, it starts off, "Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it." Actually, I guess verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord." That word "hear" is the start of that is the Hebrew term is Shema, and this is actually recited as a prayer in the among Jews in their religion, based on this passage, and they recite it. The Talmud starts off with Me'imatai Kriyat HaShema. What time of evening should we recite the Shema? And it's something that they would do every day. And
they did it twice a day, if I remember.
Yeah, they have set times to do it. It's one of the texts that's bound on the phylacteries, and it's in the mezuzahs, which are right on the sides of the door. There's a little scroll that contains that, and so as they enter the house, they'll kiss their fingers and touch the mezuzah, and with an idea that they're tacitly reciting that prayer as they enter the house. But we know that next for the next verse, which is quoted by Jesus, "And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might." And I think it's we tend to kind of downplay a little bit the "with all thy heart," and "with all thy soul" and "with all thy might." Those, with that intensity that we're required to love the Lord, is that it's not just part of our heart. We're not holding part of it back. We need to love him with all our heart. And in ancient Israel, that you think with your heart. It's not just the center of your feelings, but also the center of your intellect, that you're devoting all of that, both your intellectual and emotional capacities to the Lord. It's
consecration. Yeah, ancient peoples didn't think in that way. They didn't segregate a spiritual from a temporal. It was all one. It's all like, you know, we've talked about on the program before, the history, the way the ancients wrote, I hate to use the word theological, but it is more instructional, I should say, from a spiritual perspective in terms of the history.
Right.
They're not recounting history like we would say objectively. They are using it to form a message, if you
will.
Right.
Well, even if we talk about things as objective, it usually means that something that we like. Peter Novick did a survey where he talked about how one generation said, "Well, we've finally overcome the previous generation's history. they were biased, we're objective. And the next generation says the exact same thing. And he follows this over several generations about how each one was claiming to be objective and that the previous ones weren't, who thought that they were.
That makes me think of Lou Midgley and his love of the phrase New Mormon History.
Well,
I think it was, love is a generous term for that. But.
Well, Lou Midgley was the one who actually encouraged me to read the book, so by Peter Novick. But the next verse in verse 7, this is important.
Yeah, that's one I was going to get to.
And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and thou shalt talk about them when thou sittest in thy house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And the comment I'm going to make about this is some very recent studies, more recent than my book, about how you get your kids to retain faith. And previous to this study, the most important thing that they'd found is taking your kids to church. And taking your kids to church, they found, had a significant impact on whether or not, it's not sending them to church, it's
no,
taking them
you gotta
to church.
You got to take them.
Had a significant impact on whether they kept their religion. Well, this is dwarfed. That impact is dwarfed by casual conversations in the family about religious topics in and not in sort of a devotional setting. It's talking about it when thou sittest in thine house and when thou walkest by the way. It's the fact that you that's pervasive, and you talk about it with your kids in these off moments, and it's just so much a part of your being that it just flows out, that the gospel is so central to your life that when you talk to your kids about other things, it comes right out.
Yeah.
And that is, that effect dwarfs the effect of taking your kids
them.
To church.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you don't want to do that.
No.
But this is, if you want your kids to be faithful, then you need to follow this stuff in Deuteronomy, which is revealed to Moses.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that reminds me is way back in 2001 in April conference, Elder Holland talked about sharing missionary work. He says, just start a conversation and it will flow out. You just have to talk about anything that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that you live in your life and it will just come out, and that will be one of the best things you can do for missionary work, including with your kids.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kevin, what are some things that you would add to that? Because those are very important features, particularly about how we strengthen our family members and particularly our children with regard to these things. What are some other things that people can do?
Well, like one of the things that we'd had the missionaries over for dinner. You know, we'd invite them to come so our kids would eat with missionaries. So it was just run of the mill. Like when I lived, you know, I grew up in Utah, so it was easy for us when we had cousins going on missions, we'd go to each other's farewells, and it got to be a big thing. You know, so we'd go up to Tremont, or we'd go to Vernal, or we'd go to Price, you know, where we had family, or in Salt Lake, and so we had all of these examples and this community appreciation of it, and seeing it as this is something that we can see uplifts and improves lives, and we see them when they go, and we see them when they come back and they've grown, and we think, I want to do that myself. Well, since, you know, in pursuit of my jobs, I had to go to places that were further from my family, so we invited missionaries over for dinner. So when the time came, both my kids went on missions, you know, so they've just always, this is something that they absorbed, and they both had a desire to do that, and they're both very faithful, and they, you know, enjoy doing their callings. And, you know, even if some things haven't worked out exactly the way that they wanted, they've got that center core themselves from things like that. And also, you know, we've had a house full of books, and so the information is there, and they, you know, they see me when I'm writing papers. I got books all over the floor. You know, they come off the walls and they spread out all around me, and so that they can see that I'm thinking about it. I'm not just you know, going through this by rote, but I'm passionately involved in it. And they've seen, you know, the service that my wife's done and the callings that she's had. You know, she's had three tours of duty as Relief Society president. And we've also done, you know, been in the nursery, and we've also taught junior Sunday school. And we've gone, you know, to help set up chairs and take down chairs and help people move and do all of this, you know, kind of stuff as a community, just together, taking it for granted. And it's just, like, you know, like Aunt John was saying, it's kind of permeates our life. So it's not something that we've had to, you know, please go on a mission. You know, they just wanted to when the time came.
You know, that reminds me of a study that we've done, and we talk about it in education all the time. If you want your kids to read, you've got to do two things. One, you've got to have books around the house. And number two, they need to see the father reading every day. Now, it could be a newspaper. It could be a book. It could be a magazine, but the father in the home needs to be the one reading, not necessarily the mom. It's important to read with the kids and everything, and I've talked about that on my radio program in St. George for years. But when the father reads, that sends a message to the kids. And I think when your kids see you studying and pondering and being passionate about this and involved, it could be an overkill. My kids have seen that, and none of them like to read or write quite as much as I do, although, you know, my son's joined us on Interpreter, and he's very much a deep study of the Book of Mormon. But, you know, I think those are all really good points. And John, that verse right there's so many important verses here in Deuteronomy, and I think we do ourselves a disservice if we don't emphasize them. And I really like all of the passages that we have in the lesson material this week. Yeah. You know, I was just looking at another one that struck me a little later in the chapter, verse 20. And when thy son asketh thee in time to come, saying, what mean the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments which the Lord our God hath commanded you? Then thou shalt say unto thy son, we were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. He goes on to describe that further, but that reminds me of the title page of the Book of Mormon, because the purpose of the Book of Mormon, the number one purpose of the Book of Mormon, is to remind Israel of the great things the Lord hath done for the children of Israel.
And when they end the Book of Mormon, Moroni says, I want you to go think about those things.
Yeah, it's the list that goes on and on and on, and I think that word remember is, you know, I remember a conference talk where they mentioned that the word remember in the Book of Mormon is given like 215 times or something like that. It is the act of remembering those great things God has done for us that does so much to help us motivate to keep our covenants. It helps us motivate to obtain the blessings or avoid the cursings, or, you know, that thing about memory. I know that if I do X, Y will result. And if I don't do X, then Z will result. And Y is better than Z. And so I think that just, that has such a hold on us as mortals that when you reiterate all of those things, and then of course, you know, you've got, I think it's S. Kent Brown who first pointed out the, continual Exodus theme in the Book of Mormon. And, you know, those kind of things where you just have a continual remembrance that goes on and on and on.
Well, one of the things that helps that remembrance, this is back in earlier, this is back in verse 9, and this is where the Jews get the idea of the mezuzah. It says, you should write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. You know, you think about all of these projects that may or may not show up on Instagram, certainly show up on people's houses where maybe it's a stitchery, maybe it's putting a verse on the wall. All of those things where they put the word of the Lord actually on the house, that's not kitschy, that's commandment.
Yeah.
That's a way to fulfill that commandment. May not work in your decorating mm-hmm. scheme, but this is somebody trying to do what's asked here in Deuteronomy, and a way of bringing that to your reminding you of what it is that, in the words of Tevye, who we are and what God expects us to do. We need reminding of that, and whether it's on the walls of your house or bound to your arm or the talking, by the way, those are all ways of remembering, and these are important things. And it's all laid out here in Deuteronomy. And that, and we've got social science to back up that this is a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we go on to chapter 15, and we talk about helping the needy and how it involves generous hands and willing hearts. Now, someday, but that day is far from us, there will be no poor among us. But, you know, that phrase in the scriptures rings out to me, because that is the definition of Zion. That was the definition of Zion. And what happened to Zion? They were no longer among us. They were taken up into heaven. But, you know, there's so many different ways. And sometimes I remember hearing about this and kind of experiencing it a little bit myself on occasion. When you have something happen or something comes up, you provide an opportunity for somebody else to be of service, for somebody else to perform an act of service. And most of us kind of, we don't want to do that. We don't mind serving, but we certainly don't want to get served. I mean, you know, I mean, think about this.
Well, that was...
That's a little blunt of a way of saying it, but I have to tell you, for 4 months... 3 months, I had to rely on my wife or daughter or anybody for everything. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't get anything. I was essentially trapped. And I can only imagine, and this is granted, I'm walking around now and, you know, getting better every day, but I'll tell you what, how about somebody who's there for life? How about somebody who's born that way? I just think, you know, it was a great learning experience for me to be served, I should say, and I'm grateful for the insight it gave me, and I appreciated what people did for me, and it helped me understand more that it's a two-way street. It's not just a one-way.
Well, it's hard because on the one hand we get talks on self-reliance. We got one on this last general conference. So self-reliance is a good thing. And then from that self-reliance, we need to serve others. But occasionally we find ourselves where we can't be self-reliant. I remember the frustration that Hugh Nibley expressed the last couple of years of his life confined to a hospital bed in his living room. And for somebody who tromped all over the wilderness in...
He was on Normandy. He was at Normandy, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and he was tromped over the Utah wilderness, tromped over the Oregon wilderness, tromped over the California wilderness. That was not very pleasant for him. But it was some things that he had to learn as well. I think in these times, the concern about the stranger in the gates, the stranger is not necessarily one of the covenant. They're sojourners, some longer than others. But these days, when there are a whole lot of people who are suddenly finding themselves out of their homes and strangers in other people's gates. And I'm sure we've had enough of those in the last decade that how do you best serve them? one, you have the commandment to serve them and to not turn them away. But how do you best do it? Because sometimes what they need in one moment, if they're suddenly homeless, then they need a lot of basic necessities. But as time goes on, they need different things. And they need to be able to move forward in their lives and not just be in a holding pattern. And it's sometimes difficult to gauge when they need one thing, and that down the road they may not need that anymore. They may need something else.
Well, that kind of brings me to the question, Kevin. What does it mean to open thine hand wide, like it talks about in chapter 15? And then what role does our heart play in helping others?
Well, to see yourself and the other person. You know, just to remember the times when we're talking about self-reliance, and I'm thinking, how old was I before I could even claim any sort of self-reliance? You know, how self-reliant was I as a baby or as an infant or going through elementary school? You know, I wasn't earning my own way. You know, it was other people that were taking care of me and giving me opportunities. And, you know, even in the job world, I went, you know, during the recession, I was out of work for 16 months straight. And I felt like I'd fallen off the economy and couldn't get back on. But, you know, eventually things opened up and, you know, I got the job 17 years ago that I still got now. And it's the best job I've ever had. And so it's just, I remember what it was like, though, when I couldn't get a job. You know, my wife was a nurse, and she's able to keep us going during that period. And now she's retired, and, you know, I'm doing the one, and I'm remembering what it was like, you know, watching her drive off in the night to go to work. So to just, you know, see yourself in the other person instead of seeing the other person as just, you know, that, like the King Benjamin, he says, you don't say to yourself, this person has brought it on himself, you know, which is what the people say in the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, they say, well, this is, you know, looking for the worst in the other person, thinking that they must be, you know, a drug addict or a thief or something. They just don't want to sully themselves. But if you see yourself in the other person, then you're far more willing and able to reach out to them and to try and find out, you know, what are the circumstances, you know, what do they need in this moment? And I think one of the great things that I've, you know, love about the church is just when we help each other move. You know, and this is, it's a very frequent, you know, thing that we're asked to do. And, you know, they were just talking about it in our church today. You know, people, you know, talked about, you know, going to help somebody do a move. And, it's, you know, that can be a one-time thing. There are other things that can, you know, take longer, but, you know, and more of an effort. But just one of the lessons we had today was our former stake president, you know, just showed us some videos of some of the church service projects that are going on all over the place and how the church gets involved. I'm thankful to be part of a church that has the resources and the will and the members that will go out and reach out, you know, wherever they're needed. And I think it's just to feel like I'm part of this community that does that. And when I have the opportunities myself, you know, I remember what it's like when I needed help. And to see the other person in that situation, what can you do to get them in a situation where eventually they will be able to help others, be part of this covenant community that bears one another's burdens, that they may be light, mourn with those that mourn, comfort those that stand in need of comfort. You know, that's one of the things from just reading, and when Jesus talks about, you know, when people, he's going to say to people, you know, where did I comfort thee? Where did I do this? You know, and he says, whatsoever ye have done unto the least of these, my brother, and ye have done it unto me.
Well, and I think it also talks about the nature of the service, just like John was mentioning a minute ago. When you hold your hand wide, of course, you keep it open. That means generosity is flowing from it. You're going to give them what you can. and so forth. But also, I think it also means, because the emphasis, that word wide means it could be a variety. Some people are going to need some spiritual assistance. Some people are going to need temporal assistance. Some people are going to need somebody stronger than me. I remember a guy I always wanted to help move, because I wanted him with me whenever I went to move, because I could always take the lighter stuff and he could take the heavier stuff, because he's a monster.
Well, I'm going to throw a twist on this, because I've got the Hebrew open here in this.
Great.
This open wide is an infinitive absolute construction. And there's one in the previous verse here. So this is the same construction when God tells Adam and Eve, if you partake of the fruit, thou shalt surely die. And it's that thou shalt surely die one. In this case, it would be, it's translated, thou shalt open thy hand wide. You could also, it says, thou shalt surely open your hand. And then in the previous verse, it says, thou shalt surely give him. So this is something that is emphatic. You need to open your hand, and you need to give. And I also like this. This is in Deuteronomy 15:10. And thine heart shall not be grieved. That grieved is, you won't, as it says, you will not make your heart evil. It's using evil as a verb. So you shouldn't have an evil heart because of giving to him.
Well, an experience I had down in Las Vegas, I would go down to court, and there was an old courthouse downtown, and then they built a new one that's 21 stories or something, and it's nice. But I remember going to the old courthouse, and every time I would go, there was a woman there who was, you know, asking for money. I'd always give her money. I might be just a dollar or two. And I remember us walking there one time with another attorney who from Las Vegas, you know, and I'm from St. George. And so, but we had cases occasionally. And I remember walking there and he saw me. She came up to me and I gave her the money. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know her name or anything. I mean, she would go off pretty quick. But it was obvious she struggled in life. I mean, she was thin as a rail. I'm sure that money was going for a drug habit. But on the other hand, the guy with me said, why are you doing that? You know, she's just going to buy drugs with it. I said, yeah, but you know, I keep thinking of this King Benjamin sermon, and it made a big impact on him. I just said it in passing, but it was that attitude. It was just like King Benjamin's words. Every time I saw this woman, and I saw her for years, and then unfortunately I've never seen her since we changed courthouses. And it's, even though it's only 4 or 5 blocks away, you know, I don't know what happened, but I find myself thinking, wondering what happened to that woman. Maybe I didn't do enough. I don't know. But I remember that woman whenever I read King Benjamin's sermon or even think about it. That woman comes to the forefront of my mind always. And I think this is an example of that. That's been a real learning experience for me. We'll just say that. So
thoughts, Kevin?
We just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to wrap up the last part of Deuteronomy. We talk about chapter 32. We talk about chapter 34, or I should say 29 and 30, and then 34. And once again, it's the blessings and cursings. But we're basically done with Moses as Come Follow Me. So we've gone through the 5 books of Moses, and it's taken us, you know, when this runs, it'll be about the middle of May. So it's been almost 5 months.
But it's the law of Moses is key to understanding not only what's happening in the Old Testament, but what's happening in the New Testament, even what's happening in the Book of Mormon. There are all these references to the Law of Moses that we miss probably because we don't recognize them. And where it's clear that it influences more than half the Book of Mormon, and that's the underpinning law. And the Law of Moses provides some of our best stuff on repentance. It's all outlined there in the sacrifices. All of these things that we associate with the gospel have their earlier reflections and reflexes in the Law of Moses. And it's worth reading, and it's worth thinking about, and it's worth, in some cases,
trying to figure it out.
This is not out of date.
Trying to figure it out. Kevin? Moses.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's just the lesson manual says the Lord invites us to choose between life and death, or life and good, death and evil. And it's, Nibley always talks about the two ways, and that's here. It's, do we want to choose the blessings, or do we want to choose the cursings? Because that's our choice. You know, what we do, it's not just, well, I'm going to do whatever I feel like doing and not worry about it. It's the Lord is describing that our choices are important, and if we enter into the covenant, we will be able to prosper in the land and to prosper in eternity. And we want to invite other people to take that into that blessing and just see it as something that's important and worth doing. You know, this quote again, that keep therefore the words of the covenant and do them that ye may prosper in all that you do. You know, that doesn't mean you won't have reverses at times, but it's the ultimate rest, you know, the ultimate end of this if we take it seriously.
The ultimate all, meaning in not just in this life, but the next.
Yeah.
So Moses for me holds a lot of importance. I hope someday to be able to understand that even better. But we were just talking about this this afternoon with a visitor. And years and years ago, when we had moved into a new house in St. George, my wife worked for Bruce McConkie's son. And it was Christmas, and I remember there was a, you know, we never in that particular house went in and out the front door, and it was the Christmas holidays, so the kids didn't have to go anywhere. And when we did, we went through the garage and just out. And our son came in one day and said, somebody left Satan on our doorstep. And so we went out there, and there was a bust of Moses, the Moses done by Michelangelo with the horns. And that is one of our cherished possessions. It sits in my offices wherever I am, and I write when I write it. You know, he's usually watching over me. But my wife loves it because of the horns. Because the reason Michelangelo put the horns on him was the translation that they had at that time. And when Michelangelo lived, and this gets back to some of the wordplay, the differences in definitions that we've talked about tonight, Moses came down off of the mountain and his face was shining, but they translated it as if he had horns. And so that was certainly something that we always keep in mind, that, you know, whatever learning that we have, whatever we're doing, it still is subject to the imperfections of men. And Moses, he's amazing, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to study him. That's it for this evening. That's me for Kevin Christensen, John Gee, and myself. Join us again next week with another group of hosts for Interpreter Foundation Radio. Thank you for listening.